Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on traditional territory of the Mohawk people at CKUT Radio in Montreal. My name is Elliot Lobel, and I will be your host today. In this episode...
I really want the ministers to hear this, that what you're picking up on is not a new start, it's a continuation. It's a continuation, it's a fight, it's a struggle. Every day.
But first, here are the headlines. On July 9th, over 100 people set up a tent city in the downtown east side of Vancouver to decry the lack of affordable housing in the city. One of the group's initial demands was for a meeting with Mayor Gregor Robertson, which they got on July 12th. They are demanding that Robertson make homelessness a top priority, and that the federal government invest $5 billion per year into social housing. The lot where the protest camp is being held, 58 West Hastings, was also the site of a similar camp during the 2010 Winter Olympics. The space, which is owned by the City of Vancouver, has been zoned for development of social mixed housing. But protesters on site now are demanding 100% social housing. Vancouver is widely considered to be one of the most expensive cities to live in North America, while the downtown east side is known as Canada's poorest area code. In labor news, at Groundwire's press time, negotiations are continuing between Canada Post and the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, or CUPW. A work stoppage has been looming as both sides have been negotiating a new contract. However, last week, Canada Post withdrew its 72-hour notice to lock out union workers. At the heart of the labor conflict this time are employee pensions as well as gender pay equity. Here is Mike Palachek, president of CUPW, speaking at a press conference earlier this month. This audio comes courtesy of Greg McDougall of equitableeducation.ca.
Pay equity is the biggest issue in this dispute. Our rural and suburban mail carriers unit, which is predominantly made up of women, are paid 28% less than their male counterparts in the urban operations bargaining unit for doing the exact same work, delivering mail. What we are saying is that this injustice has to end. There are other issues, of course, and that includes all of Canada Post's cuts and rollbacks that they're demanding. We don't think there's any justification for them at a time when the corporation is doing so well. In addition to that, they refuse to address some major issues around staffing that has our members working forced overtime on a regular basis, and they're refusing to address the health and safety concerns that we're raising.
Resistance against the proposed mega dam project Site C has been ongoing in northern British Columbia. On July 9th, environmental activists held a Paddle for the Peace event in Peace River Valley, a region presently under threat by the Site C dam. Indigenous resistance against the dam project has also been growing. The Treaty 8 Tribal Association, on behalf of Doig River, Halfway River, Prophet River, and West Moberly First Nations, is opposed to the proposed Site C project for a number of reasons. These include the estimated $8 billion cost to BC residents, the environmental impacts, and the loss of sacred archaeological and burial sites, as well as the impacts on treaty rights. Earlier this year, Indigenous people and their supporters held a blockade and land occupation to stop construction of Site C, and one protester, Kristen Henry, was hospitalized after having staged a 3-week hunger strike in Vancouver against the dam. If constructed, the Site C dam would be one of the largest industrial projects in BC to date. That's it for headlines. We'll be right back after this.
We are the tribe that they cannot see. We live on an industrial reservation. We are the Halusa Nation. We have been called the Indians. We have been called Native American. We have been called hostile. We have been called pagan. We have been called militant. We have been called many names. We are the Halusa Nation. We are the human beings. The callers of names cannot see us, but we can see them. are their hallucination. Our DNA is of earth and sky. Our DNA is of past and future. We are the hallucination. We are the evolution, the continuation.
You just heard Hallucination, a new single by A Tribe Called Red. Now it's time for our feature stories. Ontario held its first anti-racism meeting following Black Lives Matter Toronto protests that demanded this government action. Alana Johnson brings us this report from Toronto.
A public meeting of the Ontario government's anti-racism directorate took place on Thursday, July 14th in Regent Park in Toronto. The meeting saw a lively conversation between members of the community, activist groups like Black Lives Matter Toronto, and politicians about racial profiling and government initiatives to help fight institutional and systemic racism. The response to the meeting was overwhelming, requiring people overflow outside of the meeting room and listen through a live stream. This response was a clear indication to organizers that the issues of racism are important and significant to Toronto residents. Within minutes of the meeting's start, the calm that was originally called for by moderator Paulette Sr. had broken as members of the crowd began to chant Black Lives Matter and called for Toronto Mayor John Tory and Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne, who were both in attendance, to speak out about recent events such as the Black Lives Matter Tent City and the halting of the Pride Parade led by Black Lives Matter. Akua Benjamin started off the forum and credited the activist group Black Lives Matter for calling for the public meeting after months of having been denied it, and pointing out that this movement is not now a new start, but rather a continuation of past struggles.
I go on here all night, but I really want the ministers to hear this, that what you're picking up on is not a new start, it's a continuation. It's a continuation, it's a fight, it's a struggle. Every day, we're watching children in the social welfare offices. We're watching them in child welfare, the numbers keep growing. We're watching this, and all for our marches and our walks and our struggle against racism, it isn't cutting it. Ministers, it's not cutting it, man. It's not cutting it. What has to cut it is anti-Black racism, a focus on us, and it's not asking for special attention. You think that when we say anti-Black racism, it is that we're asking for special favors. No, we are a group that in this country faced histories of slavery. People don't like to recognize it. They think that we just arise off the boat. We came here in the 50s. No, we've been here for hundreds of years.
At one point, a speaker confronted Mayor John Tory directly for not addressing Black Lives Matter when the group was camped out in front of the Toronto Police Headquarters earlier this year to protest police brutality.
I'm shocked to see John Tory here. I've never seen you, actually. And it's really interesting because I was out in Tent City with a lot of people here. There were babies out there, and I'm wondering why you're piggybacking on Kathleen Wynne's community meeting.
Community members were disappointed to learn that only $5 million was being allocated to the new anti-racism task force, noting that it was not a sufficient amount to address serious changes. Other issues that were raised at the forum included the need to collect specific race-based data on a national and provincial level, support for educational success, accessibility in the social welfare system, and the need to draft policies to tackle the persistent racism and inequity in the healthcare system. Policy changes were also suggested by community members, such as the need for the education system to adopt proactive anti-racism reporting, the need for government to hire, appoint, and promote more people of color, and reforms to children's aid societies, given the gross overrepresentation of Black and Indigenous children in care and in the youth criminal justice system. At the end of the night, Toronto writer Desmond Cole called Mayor John Tory back up to the mic after the mayor's earlier effort to address the crowd was shouted down. Cole wanted to know where John Tory was when Black Lives Matter was camped outside of police headquarters for 15 days and told him the community is very disappointed in his tenure thus far. After 4 hours of very targeted criticism, the mayor took a breath and told the crowd that they were right and he should have been there. This meeting was the first of a few scheduled meetings to be held by the Office of the Anti-Racism Directorate that will take place in several locations across Ontario.
Our next feature comes to us from Geneva Gleason at CKUT in Montreal. Geneva looks at the response from Black communities in Montreal to the recent police killings of Black men in the USA.
On Wednesday, July 15th, the Black Coalition of Quebec hosted a demonstration in solidarity with the Black communities of the United States as they grieved the killings of Philando Castile in Minnesota and Alton Sterling in Louisiana. Here is Janelle Alphonse, director of the Black Coalition of Quebec, explaining the goal of Wednesday's demonstration.
The goal of the demonstration was mainly to show our support with our Black brothers and sisters, especially in the United States, and also to show our support for the victims of police brutality here in Quebec itself. And I was very pleased with those who came and spoke, and like they shared their pain with us, and it gave a really good feeling, you know, to know that everyone is together. You know, we all held hands at one point to show like a unity, and to show that we had to fight collectively. And there's a lot of people that were very emotional. There is even many victims that came and spoke about what happened to them.
I then asked Janelle what the differences are between police brutality in Canada and the U.S.
Honestly, in Quebec and Canada, it is actually less publicized. The thing is that in America, they tend to use filming more often than we do here. Like, there are actually a lot of police brutality here that are undocumented because there is basically no video evidence. Like, compared to America, as soon as something happens, everyone has their phone out and filming.
Here's Robin Maynard, co-founder of organizations including Project X, Justice for Victims of Police Killings, and most recently, the group Montreal Noir, speaking to the specific experiences of the Black population in Quebec.
But we do have a very particular experience, I think, in Quebec as a Black population, where you have maybe the most extreme denial of the existence of racism. For example, you know, in Ontario in 1995, there was a commission on systemic racism in the criminal justice system. In Quebec, it's controversial to even mention the fact that racism exists at all, let alone mention anti-Black racism. You know, like you still saw fans showing up at P.K. Subban or at hockey games dressed in blackface and mocking P.K. Subban, right? So I think the level of anti-Blackness here is very, it's not disguised in the way that it can be in other parts of Canada, because there is this history of people in this province really identifying as a persecuted group, even going so far to identify as what they call the niggers of Quebec, right? So we, the actual Black population of Quebec, are often, the realities that we face here of extreme discrimination are often just totally not part of the way that Quebec identifies itself as actually being an oppressor, even though historically there have also been different oppressions of like the linguistic majority of this province.
Despite the prevalence of racial injustice and police brutality against Black people in Canada, the issue is often overlooked, with detriment to Black communities nationwide, including in Montreal and Quebec.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of grief, there's a lot of exhaustion of just realizing that we've been looking at the same damn problem for hundreds of years. But I think that, yeah, again, just to... we really do have this focus that reminding ourselves that it isn't just an American problem, though we don't have the levels of executions of Black persons that we're seeing in the United States, that this disregard for Black humanity is something that touches all of our lives. So I think that it's impossible to not feel it in your body and in your spirit every time that a life is just needlessly taken at the hands of the police. So this has been a really hard week for most of us, I think. If not all of us.
For more information and updates on the fight for racial justice in Montreal, visit Montreal Noir on Facebook or email the Black Coalition of Quebec at info.ligue@videotron.ca.
The Lakatos family came to Canada 5 years ago from Hungary to obtain refugee status after fleeing anti-Roma discrimination and violence. Hungary was placed on a safe country list by the Canadian government in 2012, which has resulted in over 98% of Roma refugee claims being rejected, including the Lakatoses. After having their application denied, they applied for permanent residency on humanitarian grounds in September 2015. On July 16th, the family's temporary residence status expired, and, as of press time, they have not received a response to their permanent residence application, leaving them in a very precarious position. This feature was produced by Jana Bryson of CKUT.
The Lakatos family came to Canada from Hungary 5 years ago to escape anti-Roma discrimination. The family applied for permanent residency on humanitarian grounds in September when their refugee application was refused. But before they received a response, the father and brother were deported back to Hungary in March. Dafina Savic, executive director of advocacy organization Roma Nipe, described the conditions the father and brother have faced since their return to Hungary.
Of course, the situation in Hungary hasn't improved for the family. There's still instances of widespread discrimination and racism, actually, when they just when they were welcomed at the border back in Hungary. Even the immigration officials there have said to them racist comments about claiming that they have been involved in illegal activities in Canada. Both the father and the son were not able to find the work in Hungary due to discrimination. There has been also instances of racist slogans that were throwing at them. There was also the ongoing discrimination that we see in Hungary right now, which has not been improved. Actually, recently, the European Commission has called upon Hungary to put an end to the segregation of Roma children in schools, which is still ongoing. So the situation in Hungary for Roma, at least, has not improved over the last year.
Despite these widespread conditions, Roma refugees are often not accepted to Canada. According to Savic, the Canadian immigration system has an anti-Roma bias.
Well, essentially, like many Roma families, under the previous system and under Bill C-31, where Roma were specifically targets of discriminatory policies under the safe country list, where a previous minister at the time, Minister Jason Kenney, has publicly claimed on numerous occasions that Roma were bogus refugees undeserving of Canadian protection. And this has led to a wide range of legislative and policy measures taken actually to restrict the entrance of Roma in Canada, one of which was actually doing a billboard campaign in countries like Hungary to discourage Roma from entering the country. We have also seen a decrease of 90% from acceptance rate of Roma refugees, specifically also from Hungary. So there was actually a discrimination in terms of acceptance of Roma refugees, specifically also from Hungary. Hungary was actually one of the first countries to be placed on the safe country list.
On July 15th, Solidarity Across Borders held a press conference at Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Montreal riding office to discuss the situation of the remaining Lakatos family members, 17-year-old Gilda and her mother, Catalin. Mary Foster from Solidarity Across Borders spoke.
We understood in May, when the family was granted a two-month reprieve on their deportation, that it was in order to study their file and decide whether or not to give them a permanent status in Canada. We have not got a response on that. We don't understand why they were given a two-month reprieve, if not to give them a response on their permanent status. They couldn't work. They did not come with a work permit. It did not come with a study permit. What was the point in giving them two extra months? So we're calling on the government today to respond on the humanitarian application that would allow them to stay in Canada, would allow them to reunite the family. The part of the family that's already been deported could return to Canada if their humanitarian is granted. But the family will remain in Canada. They have applied for a renewal of the temporary permit. very temporary, very precarious status. And until they get a response on that, they're legally allowed to remain in Canada. So they will not be leaving on Saturday. And they will be continuing to call on Trudeau and the Minister of Immigration, McCallum, to give them a permanent status in Canada.
Solidarity Across Borders and Romanipe are asking community members to support the Lakatos family by calling Immigration Minister John McCallum to voice their support or providing any financial support they can to either organization which has been working with the family.
Since Monday, July 11th, 60 migrant detainees at the Central East Detention Center in Lindsay, Ontario, and the Toronto East Detention Center have been on a hunger strike in an effort to secure a meeting with the Minister of Public Safety, Ralph Goodale, to demand an end to indefinite detention. Mina from CFRU brings us this report, where she speaks with the organizers and detainees about the reasons behind the hunger strike.
Since Monday, July 11th, 60 brown and black men on immigration detention have been hunger striking from within the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, and the Toronto East Detention Center in Scarborough, Ontario. The immigration detainees who have been organizing for their freedom since 2013 are demanding to meet with the Minister of Public Safety, Ralph Goodall. They want an end to indefinite immigration detention and believe Goodall can make that happen. Sharmeen Khan of the End Immigration Detention Network explains why detainees are fed up and how people end up in indefinite immigration detention.
This is the second hunger strike that many detainees have gone on. The first one was in 2013. And they started the hunger strike again yesterday for one simple demand. They want to have a meeting with the minister, Ralph Goodale, who's the Minister of Public Safety and who is the new Liberal minister in that portfolio. And they are insisting that they meet with him to talk about their conditions in detention and how it is indefinite. Basically, indefinite detention is when undocumented migrants who cannot be deported are kept. They can't be deported for several reasons. One is can't get travel papers from, you know, their home country. Their home country might deny them travel papers or deny that they are a citizen of that country, or their country might be deemed unsafe for them to be deported to. So when they can't be deported, they are held indefinitely in these detention centers, which are maximum security prisons.
We also spoke to an unnamed detainee who explained why he is striking along with his fellow inmates at the Central East Correctional Center.
I am taking part in the hunger strike because I was taught, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. With that being said, in life, you have to make sacrifices to get your point across, to reach your demand, and to let them know how serious this matter is to us. And that will take drastic measures to fight for the better of our people and for a better cause, and hopefully they take heed and treat us like fairly like human beings.
Both Khan and the detainees stress that immigration detainees face deplorable prison conditions not seen in other ranges.
The conditions in Lindsay are quite bad. When there's a staffing issue, the prisons go into lockdown, and that means they, you know, they're locked in their cells sometimes for 18 to 21 hours a day. They also get different food, often worse food than the rest of the prison, and they don't have full access to health care, legal access, like legal visits and family visits. When they are released out of their cells, sometimes not even allowed to go outside, so some don't see fresh air for days. They only go into a larger cell, maybe to walk around a bit. So what's worse is that those on hunger strike have been locked up in segregation, so they're in their cells all the time and they actually can't get out.
The prison conditions are horrible, to be honest. The ranges are freezing cold. We don't get treated like a regular unit. On holidays, we are supposed to get a hot tray all three meals, but on Canada Day, we got our regular cold trays in the morning and afternoons. And I'm not just speaking on behalf of myself, I'm speaking on behalf of everyone on immigration, going through what I'm going through. We get locked down with more than enough staff, or more than enough staff is working. But for the last 6 days, we haven't been locked out at six when we're supposed to. Some CEOs speak to us in a degrading manner. And for what? No one here has committed any crimes. To me, this is cruel and unusual punishment.
While Ralph Goodall has commented on the issue, Khan stresses that his viewpoint is not reassuring.
Ralph Goodall's office did respond to the request for the teams to meet. And they stated that indefinite detention is the last resort. And as some people might have heard, there have been deaths in detention. And we have very little information about those deaths. The CBSA have not released a lot of information. And so what he's basically saying is that rather than offering freedom, death is the only option for some of these detainees.
At this point, the detainees are committed to continuing their strike until a meeting is set with the MP. This is Mina reporting from CFRU 93.3 FM.
Now it's time for a community radio report brought to you by Ome Salma Rahimtula from Groundwire. Free radio on myphone.ca is a new campaign launched by the National Campus and Community Radio Association to get telecommunications companies in Canada to enable FM receivers in most smartphones so that users can listen to their favorite radio stations right on their phones without using their data.
Major Canadian telecommunication and mobile companies have blocked access to the FM receiver chip installed in most Android smartphones. A new campaign has launched to rally public support to get the companies to unlock this feature, which would allow consumers to listen to FM radio over their phone for free. Today's smartphones already have an FM receiver built in. This means that everyone could have free and easy access to radio for the entertainment they love and information they need. But those FM receivers are not activated by all wireless carriers and phone makers. The National Campus and Community Radio Association, a collective of 95 nonprofit stations across the country, have teamed up to launch freeradioonmyphone.ca. The executive director of the association has said that the goal of the campaign is to put pressure on the four national and four regional telecom carriers in Canada to unlock the FM chip for public use. Building on the success of a similar U.S. campaign in 2015, where four of the five major telecoms bowed to public pressure, the goal of the Canadian campaign is to have all eight Canadian wireless providers allow access to the FM chip by the end of 2016.
Your cell phone already has an FM receiver chip installed in it, but major Canadian telecommunication and mobile companies have blocked access to this free system to listen to the radio in favor of charging for data streaming. With access to the FM chip, your phone can still receive broadcasts and updates during an emergency, even if the cell towers are down. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
The campaign organizers are highlighting some of the benefits of turning on the FM chip. For one, it saves 3 times the phone battery life compared to streaming services currently used to listen to radio on a phone, and it also saves 20 times the data. The FM chip would also allow for emergency broadcasting and public safety alerts as mandated in the National Public Alerting System. Additionally, organizers also point to an important accessibility issue in that it would allow individuals with hearing and other disabilities to access technology to aid in communication.
Do you want to listen to CJSW on your phone without using any data? If your cell phone provider activated the FM chip in your phone, you could listen to radio using far less data and less battery power. Learn more at freeradioonmyphone.ca.
To date, the campaign has received a lot of support, with over 1,500 signatures to the petition. But more is needed. Member stations of the National Campus and Community Radio Association have been working on supporting the campaign by airing public service announcements, such as the ones that you have heard in this report, as well as publicity on their websites and through social media. Take a minute to free your radio and visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to sign the petition and write to your national and local telecom provider, letting them know that you want to hear your favorite FM station on your phone. Reporting for Groundwire on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit, this is Ome Salma Rahimtula in Toronto.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on traditional Mohawk territory at CKUT Radio in Montreal. Headlines this week were written by Aaron Lakoff. We thank all our contributors, as well as Aaron Lakoff, Carly Forbes, and Gretchen King. My name is Elliot Lobel. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwirenews.ca, or podcast at rabble.ca/podcasts.